It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Spring Green was voted one of the top small towns in the U.S. to visit in 2014. Jim DeVita of the American Players Theater will share why he chose to settle down there.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced today some devastating news for the state's bat population and for all of us who rely on these bats to be part of the ecosystem.
A case of white-nose syndrome has officially been confirmed in Wisconsin. The DNR says the disease has already been confirmed in 23 other states and estimates that it's killed nearly 5 million bats since 2006. That's causing some serious environmental and economic consequences.
Joining us now to talk more about this is Aaron Crane, who leads the DNR Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, can you fill us in? What is the latest news about white-nose syndrome found here in Wisconsin?
Well, part of our regular annual winter surveillance for the disease, we found it late in our surveillance season. We usually go through the entire state at the beginning of the winter season, and then a second time we do a follow-up at some of the sites to make sure that we haven't missed anything. And we found the positive in Grand County just last week. It was at a surveillance site that we found on March 28th.
Was this bad news that you knew was coming, or was it something that you've been expecting?
Well, we knew that it would get here eventually, and Wisconsin has been very proactive in trying to put as many measures in place as possible to slow the spread and keep it from our borders, basically. But we have, you know, it began in the eastern part of the United States and has moved slowly across the country. We knew it was coming, and we knew that there's only certain things that we can control, which is the human transmission of it. But the major transmission of the disease is bat to bat.
Well, we've been hearing about this, as you said, for a long time. It's been out on the East Coast, I know, initially. What exactly is white-nose syndrome, and what does it do to the bats?
So white-nose syndrome is actually a result of a fungus, and the fungus is not a native fungus to the United States. It came over from Europe, and consequently our bats weren't immune to the effects of it. But the fungus will cover the bats during their hibernation time, and the fungus is more active under humid and cool conditions. So when they're hibernating, that's what those conditions are like. And the fungus itself doesn't kill the bats. What happens is bats are designed to hibernate for a long period of time during the winter, and what the fungus does, it irritates the bats. The bats wake up continually grooming themselves, trying to get rid of the fungus. And in doing so, they use up all of their fat stores so that they can't make it through their hibernation season, or they leave prematurely from the hibernation site out into the winter where they'll die on the landscape.
Now, I understand the DNR is still waiting for test results from other sites. You mentioned the one positive in Grand County. Is there reason right now to believe that's already spread to other parts of Wisconsin?
Not at this point, actually. And the reason being is that we send our results into the Wildlife Health Lab, as do many states. And there's kind of a priority order in which they take a look at those samples. And so when our crew had found visual signs of white nose at this particular site, when they got into contact with the Wildlife Health Lab, they said, these are visual signs. We've seen visual signs as well. And that put that sample right up at the top of the list to get done. So we got the results back quickly. So the fact that we haven't gotten the other results back doesn't mean that we don't have it, but if it was something that was more likely to be a positive, we would have gotten those results back earlier.
How big a place for bats is Wisconsin? How many colonies are there?
Well, the ones that we know of, we have well over 100, and Wisconsin is a little different than some of the other states in that the majority of our hibernation sites are mines, not caves. We have much fewer caves than we do man-made mines, but the bats do use those. And actually, Wisconsin is the home to some of the largest winter hibernating sites in the upper Midwest. So we have historically, we've had a very comparatively large and healthy bat population.
So it sounds like Wisconsin is pretty huge as far as bat populations. How devastating do you expect white nose to be in Wisconsin now that it's gotten here?
Well, it takes a couple of years before you see the mortality rate. Usually in the first year, it's very low, and the second year is when you really see the major die-offs, and then the third year is kind of the end of it, and you see who the survivors are, basically. But the white nose is, you know, the mortality rate associated with white nose is 95%.
Mm.
So it's, you know, in the next several years, theoretically, we'll be losing 95% of our cave bats.
95% of the cave bats. And this is a syndrome, a disease that's been around for a while. Has science made any inroads in containing it or minimizing the damage?
There's a lot of research going on across the country, some that Wisconsin is involved in and many of the other states. And the research is looking at all different kinds of ways of trying to stop this spread. So, for example, there was research into human transmission of it. They found that, you know, the fungus can remain dormant on clothing and like caving gear and that sort of thing. And then when it gets in the right conditions, it can start up again. So that's why we had restrictions on decontamination measures that folks needed to use if they were going to be going into caves. And those were at the national level as well. There's research into vaccines. There's research into how to clean the bats so that they can shed the fungus and see if they can get it totally out of their system so that they don't reinfect. There's research going on about changing the environmental conditions of hibernating sites. As I was saying, that there's a relatively narrow set of environmental conditions that the fungus is active in, and so there's research into, you know, dropping the humidity or making it colder or any number of things so that the bats can still use the site, but the fungus doesn't thrive in it. So there's a really concerted effort across the country in trying to address it.
Any chance any of those things will come to fruition before, you know, we lose 95% of the bat population?
Boy, that's a tough call. You know, the research has been going on for quite some time, and there has been some progress, as I said, for example, leading to decontamination measures and things like that. But, you know, it's difficult with an animal that is very, very concentrated, so their population is concentrated, and they fly. So it's a little difficult to be able to, it's not like you can, some of these hibernacula in our state have, you know, over 60,000 bats in one site. It's not like you can go in and, you know, clean all the bats and try to rehab them and let them go. So the biology of the bats make a response kind of difficult as well.
Obviously, the main cause of concern here is mortality to the bats, but does this also mean that we're going to be overrun with mosquitoes in the next 3 years? Bats eat mosquitoes.
Yes, bats eat mosquitoes and a whole lot of other what we would consider pests. And so there's going to be, when you remove not just one species, but four, so we have four cave bat species in Wisconsin that are all susceptible to white nose. If you remove four of the species out of an ecosystem, it makes a big difference. And so I don't know how to quantify that impact, but there will be impacts in the number of pests that are surviving because the bats aren't eating them. I wish I could remember the comparison that we've used over the years. Bats eat a tremendous amount. A single bat can eat a tremendous amount compared to its body weight in a single night of feeding. And it's, I think I have this right, or very close to it. It would be the equivalent of a person eating 25 hamburgers a day. So it's a lot of, they're taking a lot of agricultural and forest and human pests out of the environment. And, you know, we're going to see the impact of that over the years.
Erin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been talking to Erin Crane. She leads the DNR Natural Heritage Conservation Program.
Coming up next, if you're looking for a place to visit this summer, Smithsonian Magazine says, hey, consider Spring Green, Wisconsin. It appears that spring may finally be here, knock on wood, and it's time to start making some summer travel plans.
Well, according to Smithsonian Magazine, before heading out of state, you might want to consider Spring Green, Wisconsin. The magazine voted Spring Green one of the 20 best small towns in the U.S. to visit in 2014. It's home of the American Players Theater and Frank Lloyd Wright's home Taliesin, along with hiking paths and a vibrant music scene.
Here with us to share some of his love for Spring Green is American Players Theater actor Jim DeVita. This season marks his 20th year with the theater. He's also a playwright, the author of two novels, and a former volunteer EMT in Spring Green. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, you're an actor. Usually that draws people to the big city. How did it lead you to Spring Green?
I know, I'm still trying to figure that out today a little bit. I mean, well, it's funny, you know, I was all over the country as a young actor when I first started out. I'm originally from New York City, and but I'm kind of an odd duck, and I've always, quality of life has always been kind of important to me. And even when I was out of school, I was trying to look at some smaller cities like Minneapolis or Seattle, and happened to be in Chicago when I got a job out here, and I came out to Spring Green. And the first thing, you know, I was just attracted to the land out here. The geography is just stunning in the Driftless area, and I'm a fisherman, so we had the Wisconsin River, we had canoeing, and this beautiful land out here. And in the middle of that was American Players Theater, which serves over 100,000 people a year. So it was like this kind of this paradox out here. And it's like, does anybody know this is out here? but I fell in love just with the land at first. That was kind of the first thing before I started getting involved in the community and working out here for a long time.
And the home of architect Frank Lloyd Wright is near Spring Green. What's special about Taliesin?
Well, Taliesin, I mean, for, you know, again, it's what those organizations, the kind of influx of young people and energy that they bring into the town each year. That's true both of American Players Theater and Taliesin. And we often talk about, you know, I'm here for 20 years now, and so when the spring comes around, like both the birds and the animals start coming out, then we also start seeing architects and actors on the streets, and, you know, we saw one today. So it's great kind of energy that they bring into the town every year.
Some of our listeners have probably been to APT. For those who haven't, can you give us a taste? What is special about American Players Theater?
American Players Theater, well, we're a classically based theater. We're an outdoor theater. We also have an indoor space, but we're mainly known for our outdoor theater, which is a 1,200-seat amphitheater under the stars on the top of a hill surrounded by trees. And it's a physically gorgeous place to come and to see a show. But we do both classical work, which is, you know, we always do at least two Shakespeare's every year. We do Moliere, Ibsen, Chekhov, and then we also do some more contemporary plays, particularly now that we have an indoor space which seats 200 people. But the experience of coming here, and we have picnic grounds out here, which most people come out, because it's not everybody just hops out of their car. You usually have to take a drive to get out here. So people plan a little meal, and we have picnic tables, and people usually eat and have a glass of wine, and then the walk up the hill takes about 7 to 10 minutes, depending on how fast you are, to actually get to the theater itself. And the plays happen underneath, you know, under the stars at the end. One of the big traditions is when the lights go out at the end, you know, 1,000 people look up to the sky to see the stars. So it's a wonderful way to experience a play in the outdoors, and I've been doing it for 20 years now, and it's quite enjoyable.
And I understand there's quite a vibrant music scene in Spring Green. For one thing, I've heard that there is a town Bob Dylan Fest day.
Uh-huh. We've got a Dylan Fest down at the General Store where we have a Bob Dylan Day. There's also a Beatles Day, which has been happening at the same place. So we've kind of got a fest for Bob and a fest for the Beatles. And we also have the Shitty Barn, excuse the language, but that's the name of the barn out here, which gets musicians from all over the country, really, really talented musicians that they book in here. So it's part of what's fascinating about this small town, which was, I think, 1,200 people when I started here, and maybe we're up to 1,500 even now. But we have this amazing mix of small town life and also this kind of vibrant art scene, which happens each year. And we have both music and theater and the architecture school, and we have the arts fair, which is a huge arts fair that we have here every year also.
And you just mentioned the General Store. I've never been there, but that's supposedly a great place, a well-known place for people to meet up in Spring Green. What's the General Store scene there?
The General Store is a General Store. It's just like it sounds. It's kind of lovely. It's kind of hardwood floors, and you got great coffee and great breakfast there, and it's become kind of one of the meeting places here. When if you don't know where to meet somebody, you say, well, I'll meet you at the general store, and there's only one general store in town. So if you ask anybody in any corner, they'll point you to it. And we've got a couple of other great places. We have kind of a higher-end, very nice restaurant called Freddie Valentine's now. We have The Shed, which is our local bar restaurant. Arcadia, which is another coffee shop bookstore. So there's a few places to meet here, too.
Since you're an actor, thought we'd ask you, if the town of Spring Green was a character in a Shakespearean play, what character would it be? Hopefully it's not Iago or something like that.
That's very funny. For one of my first, that's a very funny question. I went to some of the comic characters, a thing like Dogberry and Much Ado or something, and I mean that. I don't mean because it's. I find the town fun. When I first moved here, I almost equated it to our own little. Do you remember that TV show called Northern Exposure?
Oh yeah.
And it was kind of like this to me, a little bit like that. That, you know, in a wonderful way, because we have all of us. There's so many different walks of life here. These people out here. And I'm one of them, these people. I'm one of those wonderfully diverse characters that we have here. We have people, you know, the man in the corner in overalls has a PhD in two novels that he's published. Another person is the farmer sitting next to him is an organic farmer. And then there's a sculptor and an architect. And there's a wonderful kind of commingling of very, very different diverse backgrounds out here. And it's fun. You never know who you're going to run into or who you're going to meet. And those of us that have moved here over the years, we've kind of just, you know, been welcomed in the community. You know, when I first moving into the community, I kind of was an outsider, but then got involved both in, you know, here in EMT and in the church and stuff like that. And I raised two children here. And you become part of the community, and it's kind of wonderful that way. It's an odd little wonderful town for me, and I mean that in all the best respect.
What was it like being an EMT in this small town? Very different, I imagine, than being an actor.
Yeah, well, it was wonderful, you know, because I'm from a big city. So I remember when I saw a sign for volunteer ambulance, you know, workers and EMTs. I just always thought there always were ambulances. I was from New York. I never even thought that some towns have volunteers. So. It was actually, I learned how to be a part of a community because as an actor, you're an itinerant. You're all over the country. You never put down roots anywhere. So being an EMT, the great kind of, the unexpected result or, you know, that I also got from it, other than just the reward of being able to help your, you know, your neighbors was running into people I would never run into in my usual line of work. And so I've met people from, you know, every walk of life in this town. And that was great for getting me into the community, too, because I got to come, you know, I'm not just that actor that comes in here for the summers. No, this is a guy that lives here, and he's raising kids. And so it was a wonderful way that put me together with people that I probably never would have met before.
And, now, a lot of what we've been talking about today in Spring Green, the theater, for example, Taliesin, it seems like stuff that's best enjoyed in the warmer months. But is Spring Green just a summer town, or can you find stuff to do there any season?
Well, I'm sure you can, and you know, it depends on what you like to do, of course. It does get very quiet here in the winter months, and which some of us, I think, really like. I will speak for myself. I enjoy the winter months when it gets a little quiet, but I'm a writer, too, so I have a very, very busy time 6 months a year, and then it kind of quiets down, and I actually enjoy it at that time of year. But, boy, there's something out here for almost everyone. I'm not sure how deeply into the winter you go, you know, but I fish up until everything ice is over, and then I'm not exactly an ice fisherman, although I've been taken out ice fishing. They are crazy men and women. But I've done it a few times, and I already started fishing this year already. I get in the water as early in April as I can, so I love fishing out here. And but I say, you know, the hunting and the hiking and the canoeing and lots of camping. A lot of people that come to APT camp around here, too, which is fun. So there's lots of stuff to do out here.
Briefly, I wanted to ask before I let you go, a new season, who are you going to be this year on the stage?
Well, I'm very fortunate. I'm actually directing at the top of the year. I'm directing Romeo and Juliet, which happened to be, I played Romeo, I can't, how many years ago? Actually, it was 20 years ago. Romeo was the first play I was in at APT. I was in Chicago, and I got offered a job. This is 20 years ago. which brought me out here. And I was much younger, and I was fortunate to be able to play the role of Romeo. And that's the role I was doing when I first met Spring Green. And 20 years later, here I am, and established in the community. I am now directing that show.
That's great. So. Jim, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
It's great. Thanks for talking with me.
That Spring Green was voted one of the 20 small towns in America to visit in 2014 by Smithsonian Magazine. We've been speaking with actor Jim DeVita and director Jim DeVita of the American Players Theater.
First, for weeks now, the search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 has had rescue workers and concerned citizens scouring the oceans with a fine-tooth comb, looking for signs of the plane.
There have been plenty of objects sighted off the Australian coast, but they often turn out to be things like discarded fishing equipment, cargo container parts, and everyday trash. Turns out there's a lot of junk in our oceans, and the search for the plane is shining a spotlight on that problem.
Joining us now to talk about it is Eric Galbraith, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at McGill University. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, ocean trash isn't a new problem, but it happens to be in the spotlight right now thanks to the missing Flight 370. As someone who studies the world's oceans, how worried are you about the amount of trash floating around out there?
I mean, as somebody who enjoys the oceans, I've always been troubled by the amount of trash that we see on beaches, and it's becoming more and more common to see it out in the open ocean. So, I mean, I'm definitely, it's always been an aesthetic problem for me. We're making it messy, and it's not the beautiful place that it once was. And I'm becoming more and more concerned, actually, about the effects that this may be having on the marine ecosystem as the plastic becomes something that's consumed more and more regularly by all kinds of animals in the ocean without really a very good idea of what the effect is on the animals.
And it goes all the way up the food chain to humans, if I understand it, because of the fish, the little fish will eat the plastic, bigger fish eat those fish, and then we eat the fish, so the plastic ends up right back in us.
Exactly. I mean, I think humans are probably usually pretty good at making sure that we don't eat the plastic pieces directly, but I mean, we've actually, it's been found that of animals like seals that, you know, don't cut their fish open and clean them carefully before they eat them, they actually get even large pieces of plastic that are consumed directly. That's been found to happen in seal populations. And that, speaking of plastic that you can see, there's also the problem of microscopic plastic particles that you can't see, which are just becoming a pervasive part of the global environment.
And it's probably hard to determine how much trash is in the oceans, evidently a lot, but do we have a general estimate about how much is out there?
Well, it's difficult, actually. So we know how much plastic we produce. People around the world now produce something like 300 million metric tons of plastic every year. So just to put that in perspective, that's about 90 pounds of plastic per person on the planet. So people in Western societies like us consume much more plastic than that per person.
Wait,
per
was
year.
That per year? 90
per
pounds
year.
Of plastic a 90 year.
90 pounds of plastic per person per year. So that's a lot of plastic. And where is it going? Well, we don't really have a great idea for where it all ends up. Some of it is in heavy plastic that certainly ends up in landfills, but a lot of it is in light plastic items, you know, bottles, different kinds of food packaging. And that stuff is much more easily blown or washed by rivers into the ocean. So people estimate usually something like 5%, perhaps, of all the plastic that's produced ends up going into the ocean, just because it's downstream from everywhere. So if it gets into the water system, it ends up in the ocean. But when we actually go out in the ocean to try and measure the amount of plastic that's out there, we'd usually find concentrations that are much smaller than this. So to measure the concentration of plastic that's actually there, you need to take a net. You need to take some kind of a net out on a ship and drag that net through the water. And then you bring the net onto the ship and empty out what's caught in the end of it. And then you can count it on a screen or look at it in a microscope. And people have been doing these surveys in the parts of the oceans where plastic has been collecting most heavily. And they find that the concentrations there are actually much less than you would guess, given how much plastic we think is going into the ocean. So this means it must be breaking down into particles that are too small to be caught in the nets, so microscopic plastics, and some amount must be passing through the food chain and sinking down into the deep ocean.
I was going to ask you about the deep ocean now. We know about some of the the garbage. They've been called garbage islands in these gyres, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But what else might get to the bottom? What sort of trash or what other things might be down at the depth?
Well, plastic can sink. There are different kinds of plastic, and they have different densities. So some of that plastic tends to, you know, it really floats, so it stays up at the surface. It's really hard to push it down. But other plastic is dense enough that it can sink, and especially if it's biofouled. So that means if there are ocean plants and animals that grow on the plastic, I mean, there are no surfaces available in most of the ocean, which is actually kind of difficult for life. So when organisms in the water find a surface that they can grow on, they colonize it, and that can make it heavier and help it to sink. So there's certainly a rain of plastic, you know, where you can imagine it snowing down through the ocean towards the dark abyssal ocean. And we don't have a way to quantify that. We're not really sure how much of that is going on.
In terms of what exactly is floating out there, what are the most common things that are polluting the ocean?
Well, there's, if you go out and look, there are lots of plastic bottles, plastic bags, especially in coastal areas. When you get further offshore, those things tend to be broken down into smaller fragments. One of the kinds of big objects that you find a lot out in the open ocean is pieces of fishing gear. So there's just always fishermen losing nets in bad weather or abandoning nets if they get too badly tangled to use anymore. And because they have floats on them, those nets, called ghost nets, can wander around the ocean for many years. There's also some amount of garbage that's thrown off of ships. This is decreasing now. There's new legislation to make it illegal to throw plastics and dangerous forms of garbage overboard of ships, even in international waters. But for many years, it was perfectly acceptable to throw your garbage overboard, and so some of that is still hanging around in the ocean. And there's also garbage that is cargo that was being carried on ships in the open ocean and was lost in storms. So there's always cargo being lost from ships in storms. It's also contributing to garbage in the high seas.
I'd heard that hospital waste tended to be a big problem at one point. Is that still as big an issue today?
It could be. I don't know.
Now, the gyres are something that's gotten a lot of publicity. They've been called, I think, the Pacific one, garbage islands, sort of these big swirling funnels of garbage that float on the top of the water. Can you tell us about those and where they are and how big that problem is?
Sure. So gyres are an important part of the global ocean circulation. So seawater is always circulating around the ocean, just like, you know, the blood circulates around in our bloodstream. And, you know, our blood is moved around by our heart beating, whereas the ocean is moving around because winds are blowing over the ocean. Now, the way the winds usually blow over the ocean, they blow east over some parts of the ocean and west over other parts of the ocean. And if there were no continents in the world, then the ocean would circulate like Jupiter. I don't know if you've seen pictures of Jupiter, but there are just these bands of clouds that circle around it like rings. But because we've got continents on the world and on the Earth that block the water so it can't just flow around in bands with the wind, instead it circles around. And so you get in each ocean basin a giant, slowly swirling circular current, and that's called a gyre. And so there are five big gyres in the world. There's two in the Atlantic, two in the Pacific, and one in the Indian Ocean. Now, the reason this becomes interesting for thinking about garbage is because as the water swirls around in those gyres, it swirls gradually towards the center. So we say it converges. So there's a convergence of water in the gyres towards the middle. And because the plastic floats, for the floating part of the plastic anyway, the floating plastic is moved gradually towards the centers of the gyres. Then when the water reaches the centers, it piles up and actually goes down. So the water itself, when it converges in the center, flows downward. You know, it flows down a few hundred feet into the ocean. But because the plastic is floating, it's left behind at the surface. So the overall effect you can think of as being something like one of the filters maybe you have in your bathtub, where as the water drains out through the filter in the bathtub drain, the filter catches all of the hairs and whatever other debris there was in the bath. So in the same kind of way, the gyres concentrate the plastics.
So if we've got these concentrated plastic funnels going on in these gyre areas, why can't we go with a very fine, very large net and scoop up the plastic and clean up the ocean?
Yes, that would be great if they were concentrated enough. However, the convergence isn't, I mean, it's not quite like a filter in the bathtub, because it's happening over a very large area. So instead of this being, you know, something like the size of Manhattan, which would be a nice, easy size to deal with if the garbage were that concentrated, instead, it's like the whole size of the Midwest.
Hmm.
So it's spread over such a huge area. There's only a piece of plastic every foot or a couple feet, and they're small pieces. So going out to clean it up is just impossible. It would be much too expensive.
We're talking right now with Eric Galbraith about the amount of trash and other junk in the world's oceans and what, if anything, we can do about it. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Have you seen this problem firsthand? Are you concerned about it? And what would you like to see done? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to Eric Galbraith of McGill University about all of the trash in the world's oceans. It's an issue that's been highlighted by the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines plane. A lot of times, suspected pieces of airline debris turn out to be floating pieces of junk. You can join the conversation with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think our responsibility is when it comes to dealing with trash in the ocean, the trash that's already there, or keeping trash from getting into the ocean in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Eric, if we can't easily clean up the oceans, we can't trawl it with a big net and get all the plastic and the junk out of there, what can we do both at a legislative and a personal level to help clean up the oceans?
Well, there's really two things that can be done as far as I can see. One is that we can we can change the plastics that we're using to have plastics that don't last as long under the conditions out there in the ocean. So, I mean, there's a lot of sunlight in the ocean, which can help to break down plastic. But a lot of the plastics that we use are much more durable than they need to be. So they'll last for many centuries out in the ocean, whereas probably we just need some kind of biodegradable plastic that could break down within a few months. So that's one big thing we can do, just switch to shorter plastic lifetimes. But then on a more bigger level, I think what we really need to do is just try and think more about the production of stuff. We need to try and organize our economies in a way that produces less disposable stuff. So whether that means changing our buying habits, our consumption habits, or just the way we value things, just to try and go to, overall, a lower consumption lifestyle.
And I want to go to our phones now. We have Chris joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, yep.
What did you want to say? Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder if you have any idea what percentage of trash is from natural disasters like the tsunamis or the tidal waves that come into land and then sweep everything back out.
All right, good question. Thanks a lot, Chris. And what about tsunamis, other natural disasters that might be contributing?
Yeah, great question. So that definitely leads to hotspots. So after the big Japanese tsunami, there was a huge amount of garbage washed into the ocean. People ran computer models to see where this garbage spread, and it's spread across the whole Pacific Ocean in some cases. So, you know, locally, for short periods of time, that is a big source of trash. It doesn't dominate over the long term. It's more dispersed garbage sources from all over the planet.
Mm.
But definitely that's a really dramatic instance whenever that happens.
Well, thank you for that question, Chris. And Eric, you were talking about how we need to move to a mindset where we make less stuff and we don't package. We have disposable or more biodegradable plastics. And that made me think of I think it was a year or so ago, SunChips introduced a biodegradable SunChip bag. And I remember getting one and thinking that it was loud. And that's what everyone else thought, that it was too loud. And then it was very crinkly. And so SunChip stopped making it because it was too loud. So it just makes me think, is this something that people are behind? Or if they're worried about a loud SunChip bag, is there the will there to do even more drastic things, to reduce consumption, to move to different plastics? Are people behind this enough?
Well, yes. I hadn't been aware of that example. That's a good one. No, I mean, I think globally across the world, unfortunately, we're not right now. But that doesn't mean that we won't be. I mean, I think we make choices every day based on how we value different experiences, how we think about the future, and I think there needs to be a value shift in order for us to start doing these things. And it's really about making plans for the future. There's a shift among some industries, some companies, for example, the refrigerator industry in Europe, to think about the full lifetime of a refrigerator that they build. So rather than just produce something thinking about its useful lifetime, you plan for what's going to happen at the end of the useful lifetime of that object. And so these refrigerator companies are now, they're actually required to plan for eventually taking the fridge back when the users are finished with it, when nobody wants it anymore, and then recycling it, turning it into new products so that it doesn't just end up as garbage, which can last for forever, for many hundreds of years. So in a way, I mean, I kind of think about it like cleaning up my kitchen. I have a sink full of dirty dishes at home right now that I have to go home and deal with. But I kind of feel like, it's the same thing globally with this trash that we've been generating. We've just been generating more and more dirty dishes, and we're not cleaning them. And it just becomes difficult to deal with. So it's a mindset to plan ahead for the garbage that we know we're going to generate, and have a way either for it to let it break down on its own, or for it to be manageable so that we can deal with it.
Well, you mentioned that being, an example of a value shift that needs to happen, but I guess the million-dollar question is, what is it going to take for people to have a collective value shift as a conservationist, someone who's worried about the ocean? What will it take?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you figure out the answer, please let me know.
Yeah, so you mentioned the example of people looking at the lifespans of appliances in Europe. Do you see people in the United States at the vanguard sort of thinking the same way?
It's definitely coming. I mean, here in Quebec, where I live, that's actually the fridge thing has started to happen here as well. They're trying to do it for other appliances. So starting first with, large household appliances that have a lot of steel that's easy to recycle. Here also in Quebec, actually, they've banned plastic bags in stores being given away for free. So you can have a plastic bag in the store, but you have to pay for it under law. So you always have to pay 5 cents for a plastic bag. So, that's having an impact on how many plastic bags people use in a big way, because these things don't really make people's lives particularly better, but they do generate an awful lot of trash, and that trash always ends up somewhere.
Do you think part of it that's difficult is just the size of the ocean? It's sort of like contemplating the universe. You can't really do it. The oceans are immense, and we think, if a bottle goes in the ocean, if there's some trash there, the oceans are gigantic, and it's just hard for people to wrap their mind around that kind of size.
Absolutely. That's definitely a part of it. I mean, when you're out on the ocean, it seems to extend forever, and it's a surprise for me, actually, that we've been able to put so much garbage into the ocean that it's now becoming a problem. But it's just, there's a lot of people on the planet, and we're all very busy and, generating stuff, and the stuff is accumulating. And unfortunately, because we're not dealing with our trash properly, it's starting to really fill up the planet to a point where it's interfering with searches for crashed jet airplanes.
Now, you mentioned earlier that one of the things that's keeping you up at night is worrying about the effects of pollution and trash in the oceans on marine animals, marine life. What are some of the big unanswered questions there?
Well, so for some animals, like seabirds, it's pretty clear that they will eat plastic because they don't recognize what it is. They'll just they'll eat it, and then it can get in their guts. And if the pieces of plastic are so big that they can't get out again, then they can actually fill up their guts, and you know, this can slow them down and prevent them from eating enough, and which can actually lead to death. For smaller animals, it's much more mysterious. We don't really, it's hard to observe the small animals in the ocean, like the zooplankton, things like small jellies, like little jellyfish. All these things, we don't really know how they're being affected by all these plastic particles that are out there. It's clear that they're eating them. We find plastic particles in something like one out of every six mesopelagic fish. So these are fish that form a really important part of the food chain in the ocean. It seems that it's becoming more and more common that they all have fish, or that they all have plastic in their guts. And for these animals, we know so little about them, we don't know what it's doing to them. There's some concern that toxins, like DDT and other toxic chemicals, stick to plastics, so they can become concentrated on plastics. And then when animals eat the plastics, those toxins can come off and poison the animals as well. But again, this is a new problem, and it hasn't been particularly well studied, so there's really many more questions than there are answers right now.
Ocean trash is an issue that it doesn't get a lot of attention. There have been some documentaries and articles written about it, but right now it is a bit in the spotlight because, as you said, the search for the plane has turned up garbage on the radar when we think it's a plane of debris from the plane. But now, while people are thinking about it a little, what would you like to see people do?
Well, I mean, it'd be great to try and reduce people's plastic production. I mean, for everybody to think in their own mind about how much of a problem this is, so that maybe the next time some idea like the Sun Chips biodegradable plastic bag comes along, they'll see more of the value of having something biodegradable that's not going to end up in the ocean and potentially kill a marine animal. That will be more important to them than the fact that maybe it crinkles a little bit too loudly. I mean, I think it's okay that big problems like this take years to change, just because they have to change many people's opinions, one thing at a time. But that would be one good element for me that could come out of the sad story of the Malaysian Airlines flight, if this could contribute to everybody becoming more aware of what a big problem ocean garbage is and trying to do their best just to think about ways to reduce garbage in their own lives.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We've been speaking to Eric Galbraith, an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at McGill University.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a biologist who's coming to Wisconsin. She says there's a lot we can learn about nature by exploring the canopies of our forests. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.